Buddhist Summer School, Thursday, 20th August, 1987. And so we come to our last meeting of this year's Buddhist Summer School. And tomorrow we shall be going our own separate ways. We think of parting as we feel of death with sorrow. We are sad about it. Why are we sad about it? Why has the sense of ending or parting or death such an influence upon us? Is it not due to the fact that we are dualistically conscious? We are isolatively and separatively conscious. That which was near us, which we desired, which we enjoyed, is now far away from us. But this is due surely to possessiveness, is it not? And to the sense that I am I and not you. And to an absence of understanding of the complete interrelationship between oneself and everyone else. Everyone, without exception. But if one truly loves, then there is no sense of parting. Because in real love, there is no possessiveness. There is no separativeness. That which you love is everlastingly with you because you are actually conscious of the relationship of unitary wholeness between yourself and that which you love. It may be a human being, it may be your pet dog or cat, or whatever it is. It may be the Buddha Rupa which you have on your mantelpiece or wherever it is. So if there is that state of love, there is no possibility of sorrow or separation associated with the loved thing or person being in another place. Love has then transcended the limitation of space. What sort of love is this love? Is it not an unconditional, unreserved giving of one's total self to that which is loved? Wholly, completely, desiring no return, laying down no conditions whatsoever on the loved. If you love your piano, you can't lay down conditions to it. You can to a human being. If you love your horse or your pet cat or something, you can't lay down conditions. But with human beings, we lay down conditions. And those conditions are the things that bite us. If there is that kind of love, it transcends space. It transcends all events which may produce some conflict, some disharmony between oneself and the loved one. So, when we go away tomorrow, each to his own home or wherever we go, if I love you as I imagine I do, then there is no separation for me. There is no sorrow involved in it. And there is also no holding the other, possessively holding the other, through memory. Because memory is just an image. The reality is not there. In the state of real love, there are no images whatsoever. There is the actuality. The living actuality, which happens to be infinite and eternal. Now, let us ask a question of ourselves. Why do we turn to religion? What draws us to religion? What makes us religious? Consider the word religion, religio, which is derived from the Latin re ligare. Ligare means to bind. To bind not in the sense of bondage, but in the sense of complete relationship. That is what re ligare means in this context of religion. That means to relate completely to what? This, the manifested, which is finite, temporal, and mortal, emerged out of the transcendent, which is infinite, eternal, immortal. The transcendent expresses itself. That means pushes out of itself. To express means to push out of. Pushes out of itself the manifested. And once something is manifested, it undergoes an immense process of development and progression. So, we inquire, whither are we going? We are on the return journey. When transcendence desired to know itself, it had to make a very big bang, unlike the simple little whimper the newborn babe makes when it is born. Made a big bang, and lo and behold, the universe evolved. And we are part of that evolutionary process. But we are on the return path. It is transcendence wanting to know itself and its potentialities which brought us into being. We are the eyes and ears and brain of transcendence, by which transcendence sees its own beauty, hears its own wisdom, and understands its real being, the nature of its being. What then is the meaning of the religious life for us humans. I can put it in a sentence. Religious living is no other than the whole of the secular life, domestic, professional, business, whatever it is, the whole of the secular life lived virtuously. Only man can be virtuous in that sense. Animals have virtues. Your dog is very faithful to you. Your horse or your camel will serve you, and so on. That is its virtue. Our virtue consists in what we call the spiritual values: love, truth, wisdom, purity, and beauty. Now, today, I think practically all of you, if not all, most of you, have seen a demonstration of pure beauty between 3 and 4 o'clock. In the Christian tradition, the Islamic tradition, the Zarathustrian tradition, we talk of angels and archangels. In Hinduism and Buddhism, we talk of devas and so forth. And whilst there are no feminine counterparts to angels and archangels, as far as I know, please correct me if I am wrong in that. In the Hindu Buddhist tradition, there are not only devas, there are devis. Now, one of the meanings, a very matter-of-fact, practical meaning of deva or devi, is someone possessed of excellence in some respect or other. We have in our midst here right now a true devi in Stella Coe and her assistants. They create beauty. Now, how did we see that beauty? With what eye did we see it? With the eye of the connoisseur, the eye of the artist, the eye of the critic, or did we see it with the eye of the inner silence? What is the meaning of the eye of the inner silence? For that, we must understand what this inner silence is. Our life as human beings is full of noise. Noise in terms of actual physical activities, which are noisy. Noise in terms of an audience appreciating a performance. You hear a wonderful symphony and lo and behold, the audience makes a devil of a row afterwards, clapping away, doesn't it? Or the noise of machinery. Or noise in another curious sense. You know, Mozart's son was asked by a friend, "What sort of music do you like? Do you like your father's music?" Now, Mozart's son was in a bank and he dealt with money. He picked up a bag of coins and jingled it and said, "This is my music." We would call it, not unjustifiably, noise. Then there is another kind of noise. The way human beings chatter away in an increasing crescendo of sound. Look at any party, for example. The party is supposed to be dull if there is not plenty of noise going on. If people are quiet, they say, "Oh, what a dull party that was." So there is that kind of noise. There is another kind of noise. The noise of our thinking and feeling, our desiring, our ambitions, and all that proceeds out of that. It's a tremendous noise. It's a noise which drowns the inner voice, the inner sound, which is the sound of the inner silence. What does this sound do? How does it operate? When the turmoil of thought becomes still, really still, and sometimes it becomes completely silent, which is the best state, then all the senses find a transcendent expression in your consciousness. The Hindus had some idea of this. They call them the subtle senses. And scholars have more or less interpreted that as clairvoyance, clairaudience, and so forth. That they, clairvoyance and clairaudience are a foreshadowing of this transcendent functioning of the senses. That's why I asked, did we see the Ikebana demonstration with the eye of the inner silence? Because then we would see it with that consciousness which knows no separation, which knows no criticism, but which is completely at one with that which is being seen. And it is the same with sound. When we, the noisemakers, are quiet, really quiet, still and silent, then the senses verily become the chords of communion. It is said that the mystics, the saints, the arahants, and so forth, are in union with the Supreme, whatever that Supreme is. But in this union, there is no vacuity. That must be clearly understood. So many scholars have gone quite astray, saying that, oh, the yogi gets into a vacuous condition. Nothing of the sort. He is, in fact, in the truly human condition. Because by virtue of his complete communion, his union with the transcendent, he is a blissful creator. Not as a separate person who is a blissful creator. Do remember that. This devil of separateness and isolativeness has become the angel of the Lord who brings you the divine message. The devil is never destroyed. Read your Revelation, chapters 19 and 20. So now, this inner silence is the thing which we have to look to. Don't try to develop it. Whatever you try to develop will necessarily fail. Because in all such trying, there is self-interest. I want to achieve this. Just live virtuously, and it will happen inevitably and invariably. The difficulty, of course, is to let the whole of the secular life be lived virtuously. I know from a good 60, 70 years of trying how easy it is to fail that way. Let it happen. Have you ever tried to love? No, love just naturally grows up. You can't understand it. You don't know why it happens that way, but it happens. And when it happens that way, really, then it is magic. Then there's complete harmony between the loved ones. The world as a whole has thought of love in terms of sexual possession and experience. Now, sexual expression is one of the profoundest expressions of love. But which human beings ever realized that? There is an upsurge of energy, of an energy which wants to express itself through sexual relations. Now there are hints in some of the Upanishads, for instance, which, if really understood, can tell us something about the art of marital congress. When man and wife are really in love, in harmony, at peace, not in a state of turmoil, and the desire for marital congress arises quite naturally, steadily, peacefully, and they enter into marital congress, if they were to turn their thought to the whole world, all the kingdoms of nature, the plant world, the animal world, the human world, and themselves, and see the complete unity of it all, marital congress in that state, it must be mutual on both sides, otherwise it doesn't work, is likely to give rise to Christs and Buddhas. And there is never a sense of dust and ashes after it is over. And there is never the memory which makes one want to repeat it again and again. Because the blissfulness of that experience has not the slightest element of sensational delight about it. I don't suppose you have heard this or read about it anywhere. Anybody has? But that is so. That is how it is. A completely new octave of consciousness comes into play. You know, you have occasionally through the years heard me refer to nature as Mrs. God. Well, nature is Mrs. God. And the creation of the universe is the result of the union between God and Mrs. God. Because the transcendent holds in potentiality everything that emerges out of it. If man and woman can understand this kind of thing and treat it with the utmost reverence, peacefully, we might have a very different set of children. So that expresses, the marital congress expresses the sense of touch, because that is what is involved. The sense of touch of the inner silence. You see, marriage and marital congress is a sacrament. But how many people in the world experience marital congress as a sacrament, a sacrifice? When man and wife hold the whole of nature in their, of course they hold it in their thought, the whole of nature in as a single unity, where are we? We are no longer confined to all the limitations of space and time. Consider this and see if you can work it out. Especially, of course, the young ones who will marry. Now, the inner silence. Again, like love, don't try to love. Because trying involves a struggle. And a struggle is not exactly a harmony. What happens naturally is harmonious. I said the other day, grow as the flower grows. You remember? Grow as the flower grows. Live as the flower lives. We are the flowering of transcendence as human, we are intended to be the flowering of transcendence as human beings. And one of the essential aspects of that flowering is that we realize holistic consciousness. The consciousness in which there is no isolation of oneself, no separation from anything or anybody. I said a little earlier that religious living simply is living the whole of the secular life virtuously. Live virtuously without any desired goal. All this business about taking to this religion or that religion or yoga or this in order to obtain such and such a result. It is all self-centered. It's all selfness. It starts as selfness. And do remember, all the God conceptions that have been put out in the world's history are attempts by man to express what he thinks is the purpose, the fruition of his existence. But he doesn't know that. He thinks of it personally. I have to do this, that and the other and realize this, that and the other. And you may ask me, well, how do I bamboozle the I so that the I-ness disappears out of the I? Remember, in the one of the very important Upanishads, I've just forgotten the name. It's in the book, The Heart of Religion, in one of the early chapters. Kartikeya the Kumara, Kumara means prince, asked his teacher how he was to live the holy life. And what place had the person in this? What was the self? He asked. And his teacher had the pseudonym of Shiva, the third person of the Trinity. Just as in the Old Testament you have God himself speaks, or the angel of the Lord comes and speaks, you have all that in the Upanishads galore. First, second and third person of the Trinity, they all give instruction to their disciples. And Shiva answered, I am the I that has become free of I. I am the I that has become free of I. Wasn't it yesterday or was it day before when I said, if Brahman used the word I, that is the Atma. That is the Vinyanam Anidasanam Anantam Sabbato Pavam. That is the self, the total self. There is only one self. So now, this I, how will you relieve it of the self-conscious, separative, self-centered I? I said the other day in one of the talks, be conscious of everything, reject nothing whatsoever, don't stop it coming to you. I mean, don't let a madman come and shoot you, but just keep out of his way. You see, if possible. Reject nothing whatsoever, be conscious of it, but never react for or against it. This is very important. We as we are tend to react for or against each and every impression, each and every circumstance or event. We take sides. We must be aware of the total life experience without any choice, without exercising any choice. Of course, one mustn't misunderstand this and apply it absurdly. If you're traveling from here to London or Manchester, you have to choose the right road to get to your destination. There's no escape from that. Choice is there. If you are cooking for a dinner party, you have to choose the food that you are going to present to your guests and so on, obviously. But where the life of the psyche and the spirit is concerned, exercise no choice whatever. Then this noisemaker inside us, which is psychical, will become quieter and quieter, and you will realize in due time, naturally it will happen, the inner silence. When the brain stops chattering, the Lord God speaks. You know, there's a delightful story about Paderewski. The Tsar invited him to give a recital to entertain his family and friends. No sooner had Paderewski started playing when the friends started talking. After playing 4 or 5 bars, Paderewski stopped. And the Tsar inquired, "What's the meaning of this?" Paderewski was very much of a Tsar himself. And he answered, "When the Tsar of all the Russias speaks, it is our duty to be silent." He was a wonderful character. I heard him several times. I heard him give his very last recital in London. It was a terrible... In fact, it was the 15th of November, 1932. At the Albert Hall, he gave the recital. It was a beastly cold day and foggy. Poor man, he came in his overcoat and played the whole recital. So now, when I am silent, transcendence speaks. But it has to be the silence not merely of the tongue. It has to be the silence also of the whole psyche. The brain particularly. The psyche is rooted in the brain and the nervous system. It is strongly influenced by the ductless glands, the condition of your blood, and your general health. That is the psyche. None of us have a mind. Of course, please don't believe this. This is my interpretation of the thing. I call mind that archetypal form through which the primordial creative energy expresses itself. Mind is the formative power of the primordial creative energy. The source is shapeless, formless. In order to express it, it means that you shape and form come into being. And mind is that aspect of this very same primordial creative energy which produces the shape and form. It is the instrument of order, of harmony, of fruition. That is mind. And it is universal. What is universal cannot be possessed by anybody. Take space. Can you possess space? Look what happens when people are stupid enough to talk of our space, or French space, or Persian space. They go to war. They become destructive. You can't possess transcendence. Transcendence holds you, subsumes you. That is why we have to we have to be obedient to transcendence and so forth. So now, if you do not react to any and every impression, you are in a state of peace and intelligent perception, and the right sort of response emerges out of you without your knowing that it is the right response. Then don't try to wonder afterwards, did I do right? It was right for that time and place and circumstance. The right response comes, and when a right response comes, it produces the state of communion, harmony. You see. In my lifetime, I have experienced various traumas, and I have learned from them. That's why I tell you these things. And now, let me come to the fulfillment of my duty. And that is to thank each and every one of you who have been so gracious, so patient, so appreciative as to come to these meetings and make the meetings what they have been. I have learnt a great deal in my talk. I forget on which day this week. I said that speaker and listener both benefit from a meeting like this. And I have benefited a very, very great deal in positive ways. I am well aware of your appreciation, and it is not a cold appreciation of the clever fellow, of the learned fellow. It is the appreciation of people with a heart. And I felt that, and I had known that. And of course, that is more than a reward for me. I don't seek any reward. In any way. Nor do I seek appreciation. But you have given it. Out of your inner silence. And so I thank you from the bottom of my heart. With my whole being, I thank you for it all. Thank you.